This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast in Ukrainian Studies. I'm your host, John Shetichka. Today, I am talking with Larissa Babi about her book titled A Kind of Refugee, The Story of an American Who Refused to Leave Ukraine, which has a foreword by Vladislav Davidson, and it is published through Ibidim Verlag Press in 2024. Larissa is a writer, translator, and dancer who is based in Ukraine. And you can follow her blog, which is also titled A Kind of Refugee, on Substack. Larissa, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today.
It's a great pleasure to be here and to speak with you about the book, John.
Yeah. So for those who maybe haven't had a chance to read this yet, the book is about Larissa's experience living and working in Ukraine during the war, in the current moment. It's about family. It's about the relationship of the body and what it goes through in a time of war. It's about many things. And I want to start, Larissa, by sort of asking you to just talk a little bit about your experience of living in Ukraine and when you decided you wanted to move to Ukraine permanently. You are, of course, Ukrainian American. You have family based in the U.S. and you're here, you know, on doing a series of book tours. But you chose to go to Ukraine, to live in Kyiv permanently at a certain point. And I wanted to start by asking you, when did you decide to do that? And why did you decide to go to Ukraine and live there permanently and sort of leave the U.S. behind?
Well, that's a great question. It's a big question because there are certain points I could probably point to. It's a question, what did I make this decision, or did it, you know, did I just sort of follow through on some kind of a life trajectory? As you mentioned, I was born in a Ukrainian American family, and that kind of Ukrainian diaspora upbringing was very formative for me, even more formative for me than, say, like for my sister, who's a little bit younger and has a normal life in the United States. So at some point, we took our first family trip to Ukraine in 1997 for like 10 days. And even in that moment, there was this little sensation that I had that I would come back for a long time. When you're 17 years old, a long time, like 2 years is a long time. So I don't think I was imagining 20, but that was always there. And so when I first came to Kyiv in 2005 as an adult, you know, I had like a year long research project. And I think there, even in the back of my mind, I realized that I needed to be in Ukraine on the ground in order to be able to see what kind of prospects there are to stay or to do something. I've always been a person that kind of orient myself in the place that I am. I'm a very place connected person. And so at that point, I was actually studying, researching, you know, architecture in Kyiv. Then I decided to do a master's at Kyiv Mohyla Academy in cultural studies. And it was kind of like a step-by-step. I don't know if there was ever a moment where I decided I'm going to live here, like as a future promise. But at some point, you know, you start sending down roots. And I basically, you know, the things that I've done as an adult, my formative adult relationships have all been in Ukraine. And, you know, my kind of public contributions have been to Ukrainian culture. I was working a lot in the Ukrainian contemporary art scene from about like 2006 till 2017. By the time the Revolution of Dignity came about and I, you know, put in those hours on Maidan, I mean, it just becomes, you become very tied in a very visceral and political way to a place, to a people, to communities, and those bonds have continued to grow.
Yeah, I like that. That there's not necessarily a moment that drew you to want to live there permanently. It was a series of things, and you know, I think sometimes there are moments for people of, you know, especially you mentioned that you moved there in 2005. So you know, this shortly after the Orange Revolution, of course, and then you're very active on Maidan, which I think for many people, especially of a certain age, but not particularly just age, was a moment, a defining moment for them. You know, in Ukraine, of course, almost everyone played a role in some way, and it determined the future of Ukraine and this current moment that we're in now with the war. But it also, I think, sort of awoken people outside of Ukraine to Ukraine. That was, you know, Maidan was really important for that. But you know, I appreciate that you sort of say this is a series of events that led you there, but I want to ask you too about, you know, the sort of role of your extended family, your grandparents in particular, who had to leave Ukraine. And, you know, I think this is sort of a central thing to your book is when you're talking about a kind of refugee, there's a lineage here with your grandparents, and you talk a lot about your connection to them. And I'm wondering if you could, you know, for our listeners, say a bit about your grandparents, where they were in Ukraine, what happened to them, you know, give us a little bit of their sort of life trajectory and maybe say a few words about whether you see yourself sort of following in their footsteps of going back to Ukraine to sort of live a life that was stripped from them in any way. I wonder if you feel that way or if perhaps you're doing a little bit of that, but also crafting, you know, your own life. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. All four of my grandparents on both sides were born in Ukraine. My mother's family, they all come from Western Ukraine, the area that we call Halychyna or Galicia. My mother's parents, you could say they belonged to kind of, you know, cultural educated intelligentsia class. My mother's mother was relatively well off in Ukraine. Her father was more of a kind of self-starter who maybe didn't grow up in a very well-off family, but he graduated from the Lviv Polytechnic Institute. And they were married already. They were a little bit older when World War II broke out. And they were working on Shaptytsky's estate. And so they fled Ukraine during the war. Basically, they were fleeing violence from Polish insurgents who had promised to kill my grandfather. And so their story was more independent. Like they left for Europe and they kind of got by for the rest of the war and shortly after the war without living in displaced persons camps. You know, they had their own connections. And my mother was born in Europe shortly after the war and then moved to the United States when she was about two. So they grew up in the U.S. You know, my mother grew up in the U.S. and her older brother, too. Whereas my father's family, they were from villages in Western Ukraine. My grandmother was born in a house that had a dirt floor, which I saw, like, I think, in 2006. And they didn't have, you know, say the luxury of a large education. My father's parents were teenagers when the Nazis occupied Ukraine and they took each of them separately. They didn't know each other at that point, but each of them were taken by German soldiers to go work as forced laborers in Germany. They were fortunate to survive that period. And after the war, they met in a displaced persons camp, got married there. They actually moved to England first and then later to the United States, which is also kind of a story about the power of personal connections in the sense that, like, my grandparents, my father's parents lived in England for 10 years, but it was their friends from the displaced persons camp, other Ukrainians, who drew them to move to the United States eventually. And when I was born and growing up in the United States, I mean, it was constantly, like, people constantly told me how lucky I was, how they had given me everything. I was very aware of the great sacrifices that my grandparents had made. I knew they had lived through horrific events, which nobody told me in any detail. But there was just this sense of, like, horror. And it was also very confusing for me, because it was like, I feel like maybe I knew something of that horror through sensation, but, like, had no images or words or experience of my own to relate to. And, you know, together with that, they were very, very devoted and, you know, disciplined in perpetuating their Ukrainian culture, which they clearly loved very much. I also had this sense that they had been torn from something very dear to them, which is very important. And, you know, we had this mission of keeping it alive, because it had been disrupted by World War II. It was being destroyed by the communist regime in Soviet Ukraine, and that was the only Ukraine that existed, you know, politically on the map. Whereas we in the diaspora were responsible for keeping the Ukrainian heritage alive. And so, you know, when I moved to Ukraine in 2005, it was with a lot of questions. And you had asked sort of about, like, what my relationship, I guess, to that history was in my own life. You know, first of all, if we fast forward to 2022, when, you know, I'm fleeing my home of Kyiv because the Russian army is approaching, and I know in hell want to end up in Russian hands. It was terrifying. I felt really stupid. I mean, I felt really stupid that I was repeating this history that, like, shouldn't I have learned something through all of this, you know, family history? There was a reason why my grandparents gave birth to me in the United States. They wanted to protect me from something. They wanted to promise me a better life. And, you know, I, of my own volition, kind of put myself in the same harm's way. But I stopped fleeing in Lviv. You know, I can't, again, I didn't know that it's possible that something could have happened that I would have fled further west to Europe. But I wanted to do something differently, in the sense of, like, once I had put in all this effort and decades into investing in Ukraine today, I didn't want to just run away and leave it all behind again.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I wanted to ask you too on that. What did your family make of you going to Ukraine when you told them, hey, I'm going back, especially with, you know, the family that you talk about who experienced World War II? Of course, they're familiar with the Holodomor, you know, a number of other terrible things that have happened in the 20th century. Of course, Ukraine knows this well. You know, they had escaped this to come to the U.S. And, you know, I think anybody that's from a family that comes from this part of the world has some connection to these types of things. It's not quite the same, but my own Czech family, you know, there's a similar sort of aspect there that, you know, they ended up going to Kansas and, you know, integrating in the American culture. This is what you do. There's still a connection, you know, to the homeland, but, you know, the opportunity is in the U.S. and your family worked really hard to give you that. And then you tell them, hey, thanks, but I'm going back to Ukraine. What did they say? What did they say in response to that?
It was definitely, yeah, a mixed response. I could say my mother's mother passed away a long enough time ago that, you know, the years, I think when I first moved to Ukraine, she was supportive and kind of proud of me. But I think probably at least for the first five, if not more, years that I was living in Ukraine, I feel like all my family probably was just imagining that this was some kind of phase, that I would then, you know, I would live in Ukraine for a while, then I'd come back home and settle down and do all those things that they expected of me. And my father's mother, who passed away just a couple of weeks ago, she was always very loving towards me personally and never understood why on earth I lived in Ukraine. She's the one, you know, who grew up in a house with a dirt floor. And, like, the last time she was in Ukraine, I think, was in 1994. which was also still a really like difficult and poor time for Ukraine and for her family. So she just could not comprehend why on earth I would choose to go back to that poverty and uncertainty that she had left, you know, especially given that I had all of this sort of American stability that they had worked really hard to build for me.
Yeah, I'm it's amazing to me too, because, you know, obviously my own time in Ukraine, and when I'm there, obviously I'm working with a certain, you know, group of people. And when I'm in the US, it's often with the Ukrainian diaspora. And, you know, there's, of course, you know, in my time in Ukraine, I meet members of the diaspora that go and, you know, see some relatives, or they're on vacation in Lviv or something like this. But I think there's a lot less people that go and just move there permanently. And you did that. And, you know, I think that's, it's sort of incredible and worth noting and talking about, because you made the decision to go back to the homeland and to, you know, really sort of immerse yourself in Ukraine fully with, you know, all the reservations there at the same time of, you know, you're excited, but also nervous about what it brings. It's a very different style of life, different quality of life, but nonetheless, you did it. And so, you know, I want to sort of take us now to you in Ukraine. And, you know, this book has a lot of material that you sort of were writing on your Substack blog, is that correct? And I want to ask you, when did you start writing this blog? Was it before the full-scale invasion or right after? And I want to sort of ask, what was your reasoning for writing? Were you documenting history for yourself, for others? Were you working through, you know, sort of emotions and feelings that people do when they sort of journal or, you know, write in their diaries? Was there another reason you were writing? I'm curious to hear your thoughts about this.
Well, in short, I would say all of the above, everything that you just listed. I have been writing for decades, but I used to write primarily about art. You know, I've been an art critic, a theater critic. Maybe in more recent years, I was starting to get a little braver about writing about my personal experiences. But I started writing A Kind of Refugee shortly after Russia's full-scale invasion, kind of in a practice. There was a certain practical reasoning behind it, because I mentioned it in the introduction. It was like, I was this sort of rare case of an American, a Ukrainian-American living in Ukraine. And come February 24th, I just started getting flooded by emails, messages. I don't know if people were really able to call, but, you know, lots and lots of people all of a sudden wanted to know where I was, how I was I safe? And I very quickly realized that I can't respond to everybody personally. And the other thing that, you know, I'm remembering now is that those first days, it was really unclear what was going on. And people needed to know just news on the ground of like, what the heck is happening in Ukraine? Because Russia had its own propaganda machine working. And it wasn't so obvious what the stakes were. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And so, you know, a couple days in, I thought, okay, I'll just start writing I'll write a mass email to everybody that I know. And this way, on the one hand, I can just show signs of life that I'm here, I'm still okay. And it's also a useful way for me to begin to reflect on what the hell I'm living through. And this sense, you know, there was certainly, yeah, there was a sort of personal like processing kind of aspect to it, but it was very much about just documenting what's happening now. You know, you realize, I mean, it happened immediately on February 24th that all of a sudden I started taking steps with absolutely no idea what will happen, you know, not tomorrow, but like in the next 2 hours. And so there was a sense of urgency to the writing and to the publishing it in real time, which again, before when I was writing about art, there was this whole luxury of procrastination kind of thing. I mean, I was a very slow writer. And then in an instant, you lose all of that. You know, you lose the self-consciousness when your life, both your literal physical life and, you know, the life in terms of like how you live in the world, can be ended or shattered or changed in a moment, it changes your relationship to whatever it is that you're doing. And so, you know, I started just, you know, writing, boom, you know, I write today what is happening to me. And then over time, what I noticed is there were a lot of reporters coming into Ukraine, a lot of Ukrainian journalists. There was a lot of great journalism that was happening. And so I didn't have to kind of worry about that because people were doing it and they were doing it well. Also a very risky job. Huge respect to all of the journalists and the fixers, and many were killed in their line of work while documenting the Russian invasion. Whereas what I was writing was a kind of more ordinary life, within quotes, ordinary, because, you know, there was this whole other sea, you know, millions of people who were not necessarily enlisted in the army, but were still very, you know, 125% involved in supporting the war effort. And it was important for me to kind of convey the way that this war was not something that was just happening between two armies somewhere fighting on a front line. It was everywhere. And that, like, you in the United States, were you in Ukraine, could be having very similar experiences. I think that was another way, is just to relate, is to try to convey the fact that this Ukraine in the 21st century is not that different from, you know, New York or Boston. And if the Russian army was approaching at you, you would be faced with the same decisions.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and I think these are amazing accounts to read. And I think that, you know, it's probably the historian in me talking, but reading your sort of entries on each day, it sort of took me back. And, you know, I know we talked about this a little bit before we started the podcast, but, you know, I was accounting, you know, for my own sort of time in Ukraine and then in Poland, and not in a blog, a Substack, but mostly through Twitter and Facebook, because, you know, like you, people wanted to know what was going on, where I was I okay? And in, you know, in a different context, of course, but, you know, you can't reply to all of these messages that you get. I mean, it's too many, and I understand that. But I find these sort of accounts fascinating because, you know, you have Twitter messages, you have Facebook, you have your Substack. I still have my phone with all my WhatsApp messages from all the humanitarian work that we were doing, talking to people, you know, getting across the border, which to me, this is an archive of experience, and you've contributed to this. And, you know, I imagine that people will cite your book and your experiences and probably interview you in the future about, you know, this sort of wartime experience, because it did affect a lot of people, not just on the battlefield, but off the battlefield. And you were in the thick of it. And of course, you had to leave your beloved apartment in Kyiv, and you went to Lviv, and you had a cat, which you, I understand you got your cat into Poland, into safety. And this is because you were moving around so much at the time. And I want to sort of ask you about the idea of movement in your book, because the title of your book, A Kind of Refugee, implies, you know, migration, movement, fleeing, leaving, staying. I think we can talk about this in all kinds of ways. But your idea of movement is not just simply one of going from one apartment to the next. You also have a history of dance. And I want to ask you about this sort of relationship of moving across Ukraine, staying in Ukraine, the experience of war on the body, your reflections on your lessons in dancing, and this idea of the Feldenkrais method that you talk about in your book, which I had never heard of before. I know that, you know, you've done a lot with dancing and theater. You've even reviewed books on the history of theater, like Mayhill Fowler's, which you include in the end of your book. You're very engaged in these types of things. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it felt like to be moving in different ways after you had to leave your apartment. You talk in the book and you give great descriptions in your entries about, you know, the tiredness that you feel on the mind. You know, there's a lot of emotional content there through your thinking. But I also read it in sort of a different way of, I just kept coming back to the word somatic. And there's just this idea of relating to the body, things that are happening to the body that some of the mind can perceive, but other things the mind actually can't perceive. The body is feeling its own sort of emotional toll, right? The body keeps the score, if we will. It feels the movement of living in apartments with no electricity, which you talk about. It feels the stress of trying to send emails before your power goes off. It feels the stress and the tiredness and the cold and all the other things of being in a shelter when the air raid sirens are going off. So I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about the idea of movement in your book, which I think is really there. It's a theme that spoke to me. And I'd be curious to hear too, you know, how your background in dance, I think maybe helped you interpret or at least reflect on the idea of movement during war. And I'm wondering if, you know, other people have talked to you about this same kind of thing as well.
I really appreciate you bringing this up and kind of in a very visceral way and quoting passages. I'll start actually just by going back to, because we've already talked a little bit about family history. And again, the way that my dancing body, my existing body is already even marked by this previous historical inherited experience of running and fleeing. I have another friend who lives in Poland who's taking care of my cat still, who's also of, you know, Ukrainian heritage, but living in Poland. And she once mentioned, she was like, you know, that even today she has a hard time accumulating things because she just lives in a way that like, she's always ready to pick up and leave at any moment. And, you know, one of the reasons that I moved to Ukraine in 2005 is that I was running away. You know, there were certain things that I was not happy about in American culture, maybe even in my relationships with my family. And it was just easier to up and go, you know, and search for a better future in a new clean slate place. And so I've got, you know, my own personal history of movement as escape, as a certain kind of like, right, there are different, what is it, kind of like natural responses to danger. There's, you know, flight, freeze, or fight. And in this sort of the war experience really kind of helped me see those different options and see that like I'm really good at fleeing, pretty good at freezing and just kind of staying in a position. And the thing that what I learned in being and staying in Ukraine during wartime is to find my own fighter, which actually is related to dance. I mean, I had decades of dance training. So yeah, like I think perhaps a lot of the things that I am able to describe in words is just like a visceral experience. Those are things that say happen to the body. You mentioned, you know, what it feels like to live with, you know, intermittent darkness when you can't expect when you'll have light, when you won't have light. But then there's this other side of what you do with those conditions and those things that happen to you. And for me, that was like a huge insight when you find yourself being under attack and you realize there are other things you can do besides hide. Certainly there are situations where hiding and protecting yourself is the most important thing to do, but it's not the only thing. And I think that's what a dancer as an artist also knows is to be, you know, to kind of, there are always different ways to move and you choose. And this, okay, well, let's bring it back to the Feldenkrais method. This is the gift that the Feldenkrais method gave to me. The Feldenkrais method is briefly, it's called a method of somatic education. It's a practice where you are guided generally by a teacher who's either teaching a class and speaking to the class and you're moving independently, or the teacher could be literally in contact, you know, in physical contact with you, and through movement together is helping you to learn something about your own physical habits of movement. And I've studied this practice for a number of years, enough to become a teacher myself. And one of the really huge gifts is, again, this notion that like each one of us, we have our own habits of movement, that we tend to do the thing that we know how to do best, that we've done the most times. But there are always additional ways of moving. And so in the Feldenkrais practice, you kind of learn this through movement, but it's also a kind of principle that, you know, it changes the way that you think, because you suddenly look at a situation and you realize that I may be used to running away. I know that I can kind of count on that, but I could also stay and find another way to be in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for outlining the Feldenkrais method. I found it fascinating, and I wanted to ask you about this a little bit further, the relationship between dance and war, because you talk in the book, and you mentioned that you're a teacher of this now and a teacher of dance. And I was just really blown away by your ability to teach others this in the middle of shelling. And you were leading some workshops with, from what I understand, were members of the military. You were doing this like once a week sometimes when possible, of course. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask about the benefits of dance therapy for, you know, things like PTSD, trauma, war trauma, especially. And I'm really sort of interested in this of, is there an interest in Ukraine of people wanting to sort of seek dance therapy out as a way to recover? Is it something that you're trying to build further in Ukraine right now? So when the war does come to an end, there are, you know, there's a number of methods that people are using to sort of cope with the war experience, but dance is one of them. And I'm curious, you know, what that looks like in Ukraine. And, you know, are you planning to continue to do this for veterans when you go back to Ukraine?
Well, first of all, yes, various movement practices are definitely being used already to work both with people in the military, with veterans, and, you know, there are Ukrainian war veterans from the start of the war in 2014. So this is actually, you know, a long ongoing process. What's scary today is that the people serving in the military today are not having the opportunity to be rotated out of service in an appropriate way, because there just is not, we just don't have enough people to replace them and people who are prepared to replace them. But this idea of helping people through movement practices, I would say there are a number of people in Ukraine. I have a number of colleagues who are doing this much more actively than I am right now, because unfortunately, all of these things are full-time jobs, you know, teaching movement classes, writing a book, organizing a book tour, and I'm reaching also my own human limitations. So I have put my movement teaching practice on hold for, you know, probably the first half of this year for sure, just because there's not enough of me. But I'm very fortunate that there are a lot of people in Ukraine who are continuing to work again. You know, this is an important part of rehabilitation, because again, there are huge amounts of Ukrainian military personnel, and not only people in the military, also civilians, also children, who have lost limbs because of Russian shelling. And so anyone who is learning to live in their own body, which is transformed, what happens with movement education is that because it works directly with the nervous system, you know, how do you move? You move because your nervous system is constantly responding to your environment and sending signals and making decisions about then, you know, how these different parts should be. Which muscles should tense up, which muscles should relax in order to accomplish what it is that you want to accomplish in this particular environment. And so when you teach people to kind of access their nervous system in order to be able to change their habits, it's a very powerful way to, you know, kind of reorient yourself, whether in a world that's changed or whether in your own body that's changed. And this is very much related to traumatic experience, because our nervous system wiring, it doesn't separate like movement, emotions, you know, something else. All of those things are interrelated. You know, the way that I imagine myself is related to my personal experiences, some of which are traumatic. It's related to, you know, the physical situation in which I am right now, which is also a social situation. It's also a cultural situation. And when we teach people through movement, especially in the Feldenkrais method, which are very kind of slow and simple movements, it allows a person to, again, on the level of their nervous system, begin to make distinctions, which introduce more freedom. So when I'm working with soldiers, you know, they carry a lot of experiences that I can't even imagine in their bodies. I can't begin to address them. I have an hour with them, you know, like from meeting them to saying goodbye. I'd love to see you again, but I know that I probably won't. And so what I can do is just provide a situation in which they can remember that they can feel safe if their lungs expand a little more fully to take in a breath. You know, it's that simple. It's these very, very basic things like breathing that, you know, I will be happy if I can welcome a group of people into my class. And after the hour, if I see that their chest is expanding more freely with every breath, that's something. You know, they may get into a stressful situation tomorrow and tense up again. But if they have had an experience of breathing fully and freely after everything that they've experienced on the front, that means at some point, that's also in their memories. That's also in their like repertoire, movement repertoire, that they can come back to that. I don't know if this is getting very abstract, but you know,
it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I would think that they take the lessons from your classroom, you know, probably back to the front lines as well, and you know, be a little more attuned to breathing, you know, in stressful situations as best as possible. Of course, like they're in impossible situations. Like you said, they're not getting adequate time off in their rotations to come and do these things. And, you know, they need to go see their families and these are priorities, of course, but it would be great if they're, you know, they could find ways to make more time and give options to come see you and others who teach these methods. Cause I think it's really integral for, you know, recovering from the, you know, the onslaught of war and all of its manifestations. So I really appreciate you outlining that for us. I think people will be very interested to learn more about this method and, you know, dance therapy and all these things. So I know we've been going for a little while and I want to maybe just ask you two more questions. The first is, I want to sort of return to the title again. Your book has gotten me thinking about the word refugee a lot, a kind of refugee, which I think is clever in many ways and provocative in others in some sense. But it hints at the fact that there are many kinds of refugees. And I was wondering, you know, I guess my question for you is, what kind of refugee are you? And how do you, and how would you define that? And I assume that there are probably multiple answers to this, but, you know, in some sense, you're a current refugee. You had to leave your apartment in Kyiv. You had to go west. You've been, you know, back and forth to different places in Ukraine. You were helping defenders in places like Mykolaiv and Lviv and Kyiv and other places. So you're a refugee in that sense. I also see you as sort of a past refugee. And what I mean by that is there's a link to your family who were refugees, and you're in a lineage of refugees, of Ukrainian refugees. So I'm wondering if you see yourself in that way. And I'm, you know, in some sense too, I guess a continuous refugee, not only your family, but with the war now as well. So there's this sort of continuity, but I'd be curious to hear, you know, are there other types of refugees that you think about when you talk about a kind of refugee? And I'm wondering how you might, What kind of refugee you see yourself as?
I think I'm a refugee who's tasked with speaking about whatever experiences I have access to that refugees go through. I'd mentioned before that I feel like I inherited some kind of, you know, memory experience, or, you know, I have a refugee inheritance from my World War II surviving grandparents. And, you know, the more I think about it, I mean, it was impossible. There's no way that they could have told me in words about what they lived through. It would not have made any sense. You know, when I think about this grandmother of mine who lived to be 97, you know, with whom we had a very close relationship, even though I was living in Ukraine and she didn't understand why. We didn't have like a lot of common language. We didn't understand each other in terms of like our cultural worldviews. And yet we had a very clear bond. What I'm doing now, which again, that's the beauty of writing a book, is that you write something and you don't control how other people will understand it. You just, you know, it's a leap of faith that it's there in the world. Other people will read it and it will touch them somehow. It will trigger something in their own personal experience and there will be a relationship there. You know, whatever you think and somebody else thinks is the beauty, if you think something. And one of the really painful things about, you know, the things that I experienced in Ukraine is when I imagine, you know, okay, I'm a third generation removed from Ukraine. It's taken me this long, you know, 40 years of my own life experience and all of these generations to be able to see slivers about what my grandparents lived through in World War II and how many millions of people lived through World War II. And now you've got whole generations, and again, millions of people who are present day refugees from Ukraine, not to mention refugees from other parts of the world, which I'm just not going to address because I don't have the I don't feel qualified to do that. But, you know, again, my tiny little sliver story echoes and reverberates in the stories of millions of people. And if anything, you know, the couple of things that I can kind of concretely put down, if those can be of any use in just imagining or relating to other people that you meet in the world, in relating to yourself. Because the other kind of refugee I want to be is the one who refuses to be a refugee. And that was, again, something that really happened over the past 2 years of personal decisions. The best way for us to help any refugees is to stop Russia's war in Ukraine, is to stop it. How do you stop it? Excuse me, that is to fight Russia's war in Ukraine to make it end, is for Ukraine to be victorious and to make it impossible for Russia to continue attacking and invading Ukraine, attacking and invading other countries. Is to stop running away, not only literally from a war zone, but running away from my own personal responsibility to stop this war. It's not to put a quote unquote peace deal. It's not to put a quote unquote ceasefire, because I know that is only a gift to Russia to rearm and to keep attacking Ukraine until it's obliterated. So it's my job, yeah, calling myself a refugee, to tell everybody else for whom it's not obvious and it's not clear that we need to fight Russia and we need to engage in this war. Once the war exists, we need to engage in it. We can't run away and pretend that this war is not happening. We can't run away and pretend that this war does not affect every single American, every single European. Because that's also, yeah, there is nowhere to seek refuge from the war that is happening. And you have to find some way, your way. There are so many different ways to engage in fighting it until Ukraine is victorious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Well said. And, you know, I think too that after reading your book and talking with you, you know, I sort of see this intergenerational or transgenerational refugee experience in your writing that I think you said it well. You've sort of harnessed that and are using it to speak to other people who have these experiences, and you feel compelled to do this and, you know, use your status to speak to the things that they go through. And I, you know, thinking too about refugees is because people are now refugees, Ukrainians are refugees, they're spread out across the world, which has brought Russia's war against Ukraine to, you know, it's global in many ways, but through the refugees is one way to understand it and feel this. And they're in our communities. And, you know, I think it's really important to understand the role of refugees too, in helping us understand the war. And your book has certainly done this. So, you know, thank you for all of your work. And, you know, those who will read this book soon will understand that Larissa has done quite a bit in supporting not only friends and family in Ukraine, but helping the armed forces with fundraising campaigns, the role of translation, which is critical for getting Ukrainian needs, you know, sort of publicized, not only to English speaking audiences, but to many others. I know, you know, my colleagues are doing work in all kinds of media in different languages to help sort of understand the Ukrainian perspective. And there's just a lot that goes into the translation part, which is, I think, a significant part of what you do that I just want to highlight and, you know, throw some appreciation towards. So my final question now actually is, I want to know about your future plans for continuing writing or not. Will you continue your Substack blog? And if so, will you consider writing another book in the future? Maybe, you know, instead of a kind of refugee, maybe a kind of return home, to give us an update about what life for you and others looks like, you know, hopefully once this, when this war is over, hopefully sooner than later and after Ukrainian victory. Are you going to continue writing? And if so, will you publish another book about the next stages of what you've been through?
Yes. I have found, again, in these awkward circumstances, like that I very much love writing and working with words. And I am still writing on a kind of refugee. When I launched the Substack blog, I called it A Kind of Refugee 2022. And while it's probably not a surprise or unexpected, there is also a discomfort, the fact that, you know, this, it's 2024 now. I am still writing my blog from Ukraine at war. And so, yes, I encourage listeners to take a look, because my book, let's be honest, it covers a period that was still hopeful and optimistic, which I think we should return to and remember that sense and that spirit. But everything that has happened since, it gets darker. We have all experienced huge amounts of death, and more death. And that's also something we need to talk about. As for writing, one of the things that I very much would like to do that I don't have concrete plans for is getting more voices from Ukraine in English to a large international audience. Mine is one of so many. And really, there's been, you know, it's one of the things that's really heartening, a kind of heartening side effect of Russia's war and invasion in Ukraine now, is the fact that people are paying more attention to Ukraine, and, you know, they're interested in hearing people from Ukraine speak about the Ukrainian experience, which, let's face it, before, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years, there just was not that kind of interest. But one thing that I think is also very important that I actually should have, haven't mentioned yet in the interview, is the fact that my experience in Ukraine over 20 years has given me a new insight into, like, American democracy. That's something I touch on in the book a little bit. But why I'm saying this now is that there's a lot, you know, looking at Ukraine, visiting Ukraine, it's okay to visit Ukraine, even with air raids. It may be a little bit scary, but, like, I encourage people to come to Ukraine and understand how there's a kind of resilience and vitality in the way that Ukrainians are living and fighting today that people from other countries, which are protected by their nuclear arsenals, they should see, they should encounter, they should interact with. It's inspiring. It really is. And that's also something that I would like to help transmit to people around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you have, major kudos to you for writing this. Major kudos to Ibn Verlag for publishing the book and also publishing, you know, the Ukrainian Voices series, which has done a hell of a lot to get Ukrainian voices out in the world at an unprecedented rate. And so big kudos to them and Andreas Umland and others who are working tirelessly to promote Ukraine. But I want to give thanks to you, Larissa, for talking to me today, for talking to me about your new book, A Kind of Refugee, the story of an American who refused to leave Ukraine, out this year from Ibn Verlag. Get a copy, read it. And Larissa, I hope that we have a chance to talk about your next book sometime in the future. So thanks so much for joining me today on the New Books Network podcast.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure.